KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. This is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. It's been just over 2 years since protesters surrounded high-tech commuter shuttle buses in San Francisco, blocking their paths, throwing rocks, and sometimes slashing tires. In his new book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity, Douglas Rushkoff takes a look at why the success of giant tech companies leads to deeper tensions and what we can do to improve things. He joins us for the hour to talk about our increasingly tech-driven economy and what it may say about economic equality and the future of work. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, it wasn't that long ago that anger at the rising cost of living in the Bay Area and the growing number of tenant evictions led protesters to take out their anger on commuter shuttles run by companies like Google and Facebook. Well, in his new book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity, Douglas Rushkoff makes the case that anger, while justifiable and understandable, it's kind of misplaced, and he explores what might be done to make this new economy more equitable and more sustainable. And Douglas Rushkoff joins me here in the studio. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you.
Thanks for coming in. One of the main themes in this book is that we are stuck in what you call a growth trap, that we're running the economy on growth that's driven by an operating system that has really reached its limits on who it's good for. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's funny, you know, when digital technology came around, a lot of us thought, oh, now here's going to be a much more equitable and distributed way of doing business. We're going to kind of revive the peer-to-peer sort of marketplace that we had.
Napster.
Well, Napster, yes and no. Napster, except Napster was mostly taking things that didn't belong to us.
That's true.
You know, I'm thinking even more, you know, on a certain level, even though it was less revolutionary, even something like eBay was invigorating because it was letting people trade in a peer-to-peer fashion. They were taking stuff out of their attic. And so the notion that the net could be a set of platforms that let people trade things in a peer-to-peer fashion in new ways kind of emerged along with some of the less productive or distributive business plans. But really what I saw as the internet came up, and I was around it since the late 80s, since before it was the net, you know, I saw a culture of shareware and freeware, of people making stuff and giving it to other people and actually getting enough revenue from it, even voluntarily, that they could keep going. And this is how we developed email and the browser and RSS and all its streaming media, all the technologies on which the internet is based. Then we saw, you know, Wired magazine essentially came in and the people of that ilk and reframed the digital renaissance as a digital long boom, that this was going to be not a new kind of economy, but the salvation of the old economy. And they said, we'll have a long boom and the stock market will be fine and we're going to grow now forever. And what they took was the growth template of traditional corporate capitalism. I talk about it in the book. It's kind of almost too long a story to try to tell, but it was really back in the 12th and 13th century when the corporate model, when charter monopolies were born and central currency was born, and an operating system was put in place way back then that was really intentionally designed to prevent lateral trade between people. It was intentionally designed to favor capital over value creation. So now you couldn't have a small business. You had to have a chartered monopoly.
It was top down.
Right. It was top down. You couldn't have a local currency or market money. You had to use central currency and borrow it at interest. So built into that economy was the need to grow. And as every Fortune 500 company will tell you, oh, we've got to grow. We've got to grow over time. How are we going to keep growing? And just when it looked like we had reached the limits of growth, whether it was sort of an Eisenhower time when he first started talking about it, or by Nixon time, or by the late 80s when the biotech bust happened and the market didn't seem to have a way to grow, digital technology came along and people said, ah, here's the new way we can grow. So we ended up taking the traditional corporate growth-based economic paradigm and amping it up with digital steroids and doing the same sorts of things that Walmart and other traditional corporations did, but really fast. You know, so instead of just draining a town over 40 years, we drain a community over 40 months.
When you say drain it, what do you mean?
Well, traditional corporatism really works by extracting value from people and places and converting it into share price. It's what our entire economy is optimized to do that. That's why capital gains are taxed so much less than real earnings, because we want to reward people who extract money and increase the growth of a corporation, but we want to punish people who actually create an exchange value between each other.
So Silicon Valley didn't invent that, obviously. So why are you saying it went so wrong in the digital age?
Well, Silicon Valley did not invent it, but they accepted this model as a given condition of nature. You know, people who really should have known better, people who had technologies and programming ability. People, for me, when I learned how to program in seventh grade, I looked at the world differently after that. I realized that we were living in a world with all of these arbitrary programs that we were accepting at face value. And I thought that my digital peers, when they would launch a social network or a search company, they would see that, oh, we don't have to do this by their rules. We can write our own rules. But instead, what they do, they come up with a good idea, a new technology, a disruptive technology. And the first thing they do is they run to the equivalent of Daddy at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley and say, oh, get me to my IPO, get me to acquisition. And they surrender a brilliant, potentially distributive idea to the old school, to corporate capitalism.
So how would a company like Google or Facebook or Apple look different today if they hadn't done that?
Well, it's interesting. I guess the point at which they make the mistake is when they take the money, when they take too much money up front. So, you know, there was the moment when and I know Evan Williams from way back when, one of the founders of Twitter, who founded Blogger before. And I remember when I saw his picture on the cover of The Wall Street Journal and he had the number like $4.3 billion under his face. I was such mixed emotions. I was happy for him because I knew someone who would become a billionaire. But I was sad because I realized it's over. He's never going to be able to recoup that money for his investment. If you've got people putting in that many billions of dollars expecting 100 times return on their money, how could Twitter, 140 character app, ever amount to that? And so here we are with Twitter. It makes $500 million a quarter, and it's considered an abject failure by Wall Street. And they're going to have to surrender the application to God knows what, to real-time video streaming, advertising, social networking in order to do that.
And so you're saying the mistake was what? Wanting the money. Greed?
No, it's not greed. I mean, it is partly greed, I guess. The mistake, it was thinking that the best route to making this a good, long-term, sustainable business would be to accept way too much capitalization. The mistake they made was selling their business to venture capital rather than taking as little money as possible to grow in a much more organic way, at a rate that is defined by the marketplace rather than a rate that's defined by the needs of the capital they've taken in. Because that's what forces companies to grow beyond their actual ability to grow. Look at Google. Google's not Google. Google became...
It's Alphabet.
It's Alphabet. It became a holding company. It did the same thing that usually takes a corporation maybe 50 or 100 years to do. It got to the point where it got so big, it didn't have any more innovative capability. It's so big, it's like the pharmaceutical companies that need to buy a little company in order to get a new drug because they can't do their own research and development. So it's become venture capital. It's become a bank of a sort that buys new ventures rather than a company that invents new things.
You talk about Uber in the book, mm-hmm, a lot, and Uber is certainly a disruptive business. I forget what their market valuation now is. Is it $18 billion?
Something insane.
Something like that.
Yeah.
They have no taxi cabs. They have no employees, according to them, or very few. What's different, if anything, about an Uber or a Lyft versus an Apple or a Facebook?
Well, that's throwing in the Facebook is a whole other. They could keep you going for days. I mean, Apple makes some stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they have got slave labor and some awful things going on. And, you know, you got to still have to send little African kids into mines to get rare earth metals to stick into your cell phones. And they have devices that are really good at externalizing the environmental impact of what we're doing. So when you're running your iPhone, you don't perceive of it as using two refrigerators worth of electricity as you're operating it. You think of it as this little clean little device that you plug into the wall. But it's very different in that, you know, Uber is not a ride sharing company. Uber is no more. It's no more a ride sharing company than Amazon is a book company. You know, and neither one looks at its initial market as a place to do business, as a community of people, as a marketplace to help to build. Amazon looks at books as a vertical, as an industry to disrupt, in which to establish what's called a platform monopoly, so then it can move into another vertical and extract the value from that. It's kind of a scorched earth tactic where you move into an area, you extract all the value from it, and then when you've achieved that, then you move to the next. So Uber is looking at, you know, ride sharing, if we want to grant them that the idea that that's what they're doing. They look at ride sharing as a vertical, as an industry to disrupt, only to move into another one, whether it's automated cars or logistics or drones or Lord knows what. And the problem with that is if they look at their marketplace as something to just leverage in order to get to something else, they end up leaving a wake of destruction in their past or in our present. And that's not a world that we want to live in or need to live in. So where digital technology could much more easily be creating good, long-term, sustainable, distributed prosperity, where it could be acknowledging the contribution of land and labor to the business plan, right now it's only acknowledging the venture capitalist who's put in the capital, and it's destroying people and places everywhere it goes.
Talking to Douglas Rushkoff, his new book is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And we should say, we've been talking a little bit about Apple. There are some protests there this morning at the construction site of the new campus. Union workers there say the wage the contractor's paying them is not adequate. So we're waiting to see what Apple has to say, but we're keeping an eye on that story. Coming back to this idea of this anger at tech companies, I mean, in this case, it's Apple. The book, of course, refers to the Google bus and other companies. You say that anger is justified, but it's misdirected. So where should it be directed?
Well, it's hard. You know, what we want to do is direct it at people, the person making the bad decision, or the people who are evil. You know, this notion that that business.
But isn't that just our system?
Right. It's business. Well, we want to think that business has been corrupted by some bad actors. But actually, business is working exactly as it's been programmed to do. This is not. I heard Bernie Sanders, he was criticizing, and I got to love Bernie, but I heard him criticizing the Fed, the Federal Reserve. And he was saying, do you know the Federal Reserve? It's been taken over by bankers. There's bankers running the Federal Reserve, and it's lost its oversight, its role as an oversight agency. The Fed was never an oversight agency. The Fed was always run by bankers.
Yeah.
This is a system running as it's supposed to. It's just when we take that system and amp it up on digital steroids, we end up getting the negative effects a whole lot faster. So, you know, I'm a supporter of the Google protests, not throwing rocks, but the things where people are laying in front of the buses and trying to call attention to the fact that value is being extracted from San Francisco, that if anything, the ethos, the sharing countercultural ethos of San Francisco has been appropriated as a marketing strategy by technology companies that don't really espouse those values. So
when you say appropriated, what do you mean? Like Uber is really popular here and they've
idea. Uber's, where it's about sharing and people using their own cars and being able to now transact directly. Or Facebook is about people being social and connecting in new ways.
Airbnb.
It's not Airbnb. It's not about destroying neighborhoods or taking unemployed people and trying to find the last thing that they can sell and give us a ton of money. No, this is all for the good. And it's not.
But if you look at, I mean, just take a little tiny piece of that. I mean, the president was just in Cuba. Airbnb is now operating in Cuba. And the Cubans who live there are delighted because they have some extra cash that they can now get for renting out a room in their house. Isn't that exactly isn't that the kind of sharing and positive societal result that you're talking about?
It's the kind of, if you don't have enough money to live and you can, you know, go stay with your parents for a week and rent out your apartment to some wealthy Americans who want to see the authentic Cuba, you know, before it gets Starbucks'd. I mean, yeah, there's an arbitrage possibility for you, but this is not a long-term strategy for economic development. It's a last-ditch strategy for putting some food on the table when you have no way to create value yourself. And it's using a platform that is much fatter and taking a much bigger piece of the pie than it needs to. And it's changing the nature of neighborhoods, of buildings. I know in New York where if you've got three neighbors on your hall who are now B&B and one other one who's a real person, it changes the character, the fabric of your neighborhood. So again, it's a company that's in this case extracting maybe less labor, but extracting land and not paying back to the communities that are being irrevocably changed by this operation.
You say in the book that we should seize the moment to reprogram our economy from the inside out. What would that look like?
Well, there's a lot of
ways.
Isn't
that just idealistic, utopian? You know.
No, that's because why I back it up with a ton of actual possible ideas of things people can do. I mean, what we have to do from an economic perspective is instead of optimizing for the extraction of value from communities and its conversion into capital, we have to optimize for the velocity of money to promote transactions between people so that value can circulate in a community. So from a policy level, that would mean let's not punish those who earn money by taxing dividends and earnings more than capital gains. For companies, it would be looking at ways to make your users rich rather than to make them poor. You know, right now, we still in the way we program our digital businesses and the way we think about a digital or automated future, a robotic future even, we tend to look at people in terms of their utility value. And that's a really dangerous way to understand humans. If humans are only important insofar as their utility value, then yeah, let's go along with Ray Kurzweil and Google, push for the singularity when computers are smarter than people, and then keep as many people around as you need to keep the computers running.
But the economy is built on a system, and we have a stock market, we have shareholders, we have boards of directors, mm-hmm. and they if they don't make a profit in
right.
the next quarter, they're in trouble,
and that
people
system,
get laid off.
Yeah,
and
but
so
that
how do you
system
change that?
Is that system is bankrupt. What we know is that for the last 75 years, corporate profit over value has been decreasing. So corporations are really good at taking money off the table, but really bad at deploying those assets once they have them. So it's a kind of a corporate obesity. And we thought that digital technology could somehow fix that, because even though we may have reached the limits of the world in terms of our colonial empires, that we could somehow increase the surface area of our planet with digital technology. And that didn't work. We didn't get Wired Magazine's long boom. We got this long extraction. We have corporations that are acting like vacuum cleaners. So yes, the it seems insurmountable, but this plan, this operating system, has only been around for the last 400 or 500 years. You know, it sounds like a long time, but it's not. It worked really well for colonial empires that were expanding into South America and expanding into Africa. We do not need a growth-based system. So I've gone to Fortune 100 shareholder meetings. I've seen
the skunk at the garden party.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I've been the keynote speaker at many of these things. They invite me because they know I actually have something to share. I've seen CEOs leading their presidents and vice presidents in chants of 5.3, which is the percent a growth rate that they are committing to reach that year. And I did this for one of the top 10 biggest companies in the world. And I got up at the podium after their big chant, and they had balloons come down and banners with 5.3 on it. And I said, if you guys are one of the top 10 biggest corporations on the planet and you need to grow in order for everything to be okay, then something's really wrong with this picture, isn't there? You know, and they can change. They can become revenue-based companies and start looking at dividends instead of growth. It's really not – it's not impossible. We can move towards a much more steady state economy.
Is there a successful, relatively large company that's operating in that way?
Well, sure. Mondragon, you know,
what is that?
Mondragon is a workers' cooperative that was based in Spain. It's got, several hundred thousand. Well, the U.S. steelworkers are now doing Mondragon projects in America. The U.S. steelworkers are really interesting. You know what they did? They did one of the other 10 or 20 suggestions I have in the book, which is doing bounded investment. So when the U.S. steelworkers had to invest their retirement fund, they said, look, what if instead of putting it in an S&P index fund, what if we invest the money in projects that hire steelworkers? And it was like, duh. That's a brilliant idea. So now they're investing in things that are making money in the good old-fashioned capitalistic way, but those projects are actually also hiring their employees. So they're getting the dollars that they're investing back. They're double dipping, triple dipping. And then they start investing in projects that hire steelworkers to build build homes for steelworker families. So now they're getting triple dipping and quadruple dipping. So really what we're looking at is ways to invest. I mean, for us, it's more a matter of investing locally. Invest in your local pizzeria. You know, figure out ways to invest in things that you can see the benefits of. But how do you circulate? How do you do bounded business activity? A lot of family businesses do really well over time. And actually, if you look at the metrics, family businesses do better on every single metric. Better than shareholder-owned businesses. The only metric that they don't do better is they don't grow as quickly during bubbles. But actually, you don't want to grow so quickly during bubbles.
Because there's no crash.
Right.
Or less of a crash.
Less of a crash for you. But they do better because they're thinking more in terms of how do we keep this business thriving for a long time rather than how do we extract as much cash from this business as we can right now.
And when you look at the presidential race, we were talking about that in the last hour, you've got both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, both appealing to people who are feeling the results of the economy that you're describing because plants are closing or they're feeling they just can't get ahead, their wages are stagnant. So how does that play out politically?
It's interesting. You know, it's very interesting how it's going to play out politically. I mean, I think what people perceive of in both Bernie and Donald, which is why to me it's not strange at all that people are trying to decide between the two of them, or you hear people, you know, picking one or the other of them. It's because they understand that too many people, both in politics and business, are blindly allegiant to an operating system that's not serving humanity, that's no longer serving people. So they're looking for anyone at all who seems awake to that fact. You know, it's not necessarily that our lives and the world is getting so much worse. You know, it really, on many measures, it's not. Things are actually improving for many, many people. But we can see the fact that humanity is not being valued. So workers are out of work. The planet's not being valued. So the planet's getting destroyed. And that can be changed.
That's Douglas Rushkoff. His book is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. And we're going to continue talking with him for the rest of this hour. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email your comments. It's forum@kqed.org. You can also tweet us, of course, or leave a message on our Facebook page. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today, and my guest for the rest of this hour, Douglas Rushkoff. You may remember him as author of Present Shock. His new book is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And we'd love to have you join our conversation here this morning. Lots of provocative ideas. Maybe you were one of those Google Bus protesters. We'd love to hear from you. Or maybe you work at one of these companies we've been discussing. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, of course. It's forum@kqed.org. This part of the country, Douglas, is, we're in the epicenter of it all, right, in terms of the impact of this digital economy. Are there parts of the country where you feel like the values are different, that it hasn't been sort of overrun by this run to growth and the kind of economy that you're describing and you're criticizing, really?
I mean, in some ways—
Or countries, for that
matter. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, we've got the best in both here in San Francisco. So on the one hand, you've got all the startup kids who are, you know, anxious to sell their ideas to venture capitalists as quickly as possible and then watch themselves go to acquisition or IPO. But you also have the people that have been the most affected by it. And they've learned – so when you actually talk to people who are protesting the Google bus, I mean not the nutty ones who are throwing a rock, but the people who are lying in front of them, and you know they understand the relationship of private and public space. They understand they understand the economic impact of having San Francisco turned into a bedroom community and companies extract value without putting it back in. So they actually see on a deeper level. And that's why here, you know, you've got Baybucks, which is one of the more successful complementary currencies. You have all sorts of alternative models. You have more benefit corporations and multiple purpose corporations, which are essentially people who can go into corporate code and say, oh, look, the corporate code here says you have to value the shareholders over everything. What if we change that and change this? So they're taking a digital, almost a programmer's view of the corporate charter and changing it to distribute value rather than extract it. So I feel like you tend to get the best and the worst right in the places where this activity is happening. But yeah, I see, you know, all over the country, there's a company, I don't know if you have it here, called Winco, which is giving Walmart a real run for its money. Winco is a...
It's more of a southern company, I think, isn't it?
Winco? Yeah, well, in the Midwest. I mean, well, I think Idaho and, Wyoming places. That what they are is a completely worker-owned version of a kind of a Walmart supermarket. And they are putting Walmart out of business in the places they're operating. And they pay their workers more, and their workers are the shareholders in the company. And you could say, well, gosh, as Wall Street often asks me, how could this company be doing? How can they pay their workers more and still have lower prices? It's because the workers are not the expensive part. The expensive part for Walmart is the shareholders, is how do they keep delivering value into the shares? That's the overhead, not the workers, not the people who are actually making the value.
So you remove that from the equation and everything changes.
Right.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones now, and we'll begin down in the South Bay in San Jose. Karen, welcome.
Hi, it's Carrie. I wanted to know, how do our big cities effectively get out of the growth trap, even states, when they already have huge obligations in the form of debt and in terms of our pension systems as well? How do we untangle that fast enough, considering, you know, the level of inequality that we've already grown to, in time to make a difference for everybody?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot of stakeholders in this economy the way it's built now.
I know. I know. You look at it and you think, you know, and plus our debt to something like China. You know, how could we ever meet our debt? And I start musing on some of these possibilities. How do we can't, is really what it comes down to. We can't. Either we're going to push it towards real bankruptcy and failure, you know, and default on a loan to China, or we have to start making deals that we don't really want to make.
Like,
you know, really scary stuff. Like, oh, well, China, you can have this. You know, take Taiwan, or take, you know, we'll stop fighting you on this if you forgive such and such a debt. You know, or hope for their failure. You know, so they have to start spending down the leverage debt. No, there are not easy answers to the fact that we've gone that we are now publicly, we're in pretty deep, and we're in deep as individuals. All of our 401k plans, you know, on the one hand we're lying in front of the Google bus, on the other hand we have an S&P fund where we want the Google to go up, you know. So it's like we're all part of this, and I believe that the solution to unwinding our problem is the same as the solution to preparing for a perhaps inevitable crash or collapse. They're really the same thing. It's like a lot of people ask me, what do? Do I prepare for the apocalypse, or do we try to avoid it? It's the same thing. All you can do is try to right now develop local resilient structures. Find who's the person who makes your food, Become friends with that person. Join a community-supported agriculture group. Figure out where energy comes from. Figure out about biodiesel. You know, I'm not saying go Unabomber on it. You know, actually connect with other people and try to source. You can't do everything this way. You're still going to buy your car and your iPhone from big corporations. But try to find, if you have a community of people with needs and people with skills, you have the basis for an economy. All you need is a means of exchange. So the means of exchange can't be cash. There's not enough. It's too expensive. So you have to find other ones, whether it's local currencies, favor banks, or good old-fashioned community. And the more you can do that way, the more the less profoundly impacted you'll be by the coming economic storm.
All right, Carrie, thanks very much for the call. We've got a lot of comments here. Ben writes, motivation for motivation's sake is a great concept, but really lacks a root in reality. Money is an important driving force in our economy. Biotech is a great example. Cures for diseases like Hep C, AIDS, and cancer are being developed because the money motivation is there. Passion might drive an individual, but money drives an organization. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it depends what he means by money. I agree that if people believe that they are going to be compensated for the innovation that they've come up with, that's a great thing. But we're not seeing innovation in the end game state of most of these pharmaceutical companies. They're not innovating. They're buying companies that are innovating and then charging 20 times more for the drug than needs to be charged. If you look at who's actually coming up with these things, who's actually developing stuff, it's very different. Whereas if you look at Monsanto and DuPont and those sorts of places, the innovations they're coming up with don't actually serve the long-term interests of the topsoil or the human body. They serve the short-term interests of a corporation in that they addict people and places to chemicals. The context in which innovation happens can't be one of pure speculative growth. It can be profit motive. There's nothing wrong with the profit motive. Nonprofit companies, you can make a heck of a lot of money running a nonprofit company by paying yourself a good salary. It's just, can you be in a business that is geared towards creating revenue rather than selling itself?
So do you think, coming back to the AIDS cure and the AIDS treatments that have been developed, I mean, do you think that those would have been developed if there hadn't been that great incentive to shareholders? Shareholders were all for those companies making money because there was such a great market for those drugs.
I believe that with re-education, those shareholders could learn to see the revenue as the reward rather than the increase in share price. And the more it would be based in revenue that they're earning rather than in the speculative value of the growth of the company, we end up with a corporate structure that is less extractive. You know, so it you can look at almost anything that way. You can look at the Bill Gates Foundation and say, well, what – and the LA Times did a great expose on this a few years ago – is the impact of the capital itself, the capital that's sitting there in these giant accounts, is that negative impact of that capital greater than the good that's being done with the expenditures? And they concluded it was, because it was invested in so many things. Just having that much money sitting out of play is itself a crime.
Here's another comment from Gerald, who writes, many Americans are uncomfortable admitting to the existence of classes. The buses make it plain that we have them. The private bus commute is a synecdoche for the tech employees. Synecdoche, we're not quite sure what that word means, but I think it's simultaneously over the I'm confused by that word, but he's saying that it's a private bus commute for tech employees. Simultaneously, the same workers are overworked, they're privileged, they're disconnected, and yet they're also totally dependent.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm arguing, is that, they are being insulated from reality. And they understand that, but their insulation's only going to last 3.4 years of an average Google employee before they burn out? They are not being looked at by the company as things of value.
Although Google, I think, is always at the top of the list of best companies to work for.
to, as long as you're going to work for someone, I guess, you know, you might as well be at the best one to work for. But employment, I mean, as I talk about in the book, employment itself is a really odd way of creating value. We used to actually work for ourselves. We didn't have jobs. We didn't have employment. It wasn't until local small businesses was made illegal at the end of the Middle Ages and you had to work for the chartered monopoly. So instead of making shoes yourself, you went to work for Her Majesty's Shoe Company. Then instead of selling the value you've created, you end up selling your time. So now we go, we put in our hours, and then we come back and live life. Employment itself, this on-the-clock, time-is-money approach towards work and value creation is itself an artifact of the industrial age and not really, it's not really pertinent. It's not relevant anymore.
All right. Here's another question from Tanu, who writes, your guest keeps saying repaying the community. What does that actually mean? Would Airbnb just give out dividend checks to people who live in San Francisco?
No. It wouldn't be bad. I mean, the business model of Airbnb itself is predicated on a precondition of poverty in the community. And if you weren't already impoverished, you wouldn't need to be renting out your home or leaving it. You wouldn't need to be turning your home into a hotel for other people.
Although a lot of, I mean, some people that do it have second homes and they're just making extra money. They're not impoverished. Quite the contrary.
Then they are disrupting an otherwise regulated business, you know, and putting other people out of work. You know, the model itself doesn't really doesn't hold water for me. But I don't believe in the redistribution of revenue after the fact. I don't think that what we do is like what Piketty argued in Capital in the 21st Century, that the answer to this poor distribution of wealth is to tax more and to take the spoils of capitalism and distribute them more fairly. No, what I'm arguing is that we pre-distribute the means of value creation ahead of time so that workers own the tools of production. Workers own the platforms that they're working on. So the way for an Uber to pay back to its community is not to take money afterwards, but let the drivers be the owners of the platform rather than these VCs. And the money that the VCs are putting into Uber is not so that Uber can operate. That's a pretty inexpensive little app. It's so that Uber can change the laws so it can lobby effectively to put other people out of business.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And we're in San Jose. Steve, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I was just curious as to how the author would characterize his kind of his philosophy. I mean, is it like a humanitarian capitalism or a type of socialism? If that's possible that he would care to characterize.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to put a name on it, I would use the word distributism, which is something actually the popes came up with shortly after Marx. And what they were arguing was just what we were talking about, was that, you know, Marx is right that capitalism ends up unfair, but the capitalists are right that people should have the freedom to earn money and have profit motive and make something of themselves. But what they said was the one condition, well, actually they had two conditions in distributism. One is that workers should own the means of production. They should have access to the tools for the creating value. So whether it's the carpenter owning his hammers or the Uber drivers owning the platform or the workers at Winco owning their company, it changes the dynamic because now you don't have foreign extractive shareholders living off the labor of these people. Everyone is participating. Or if there are shareholders, at least they're just one stakeholder in a larger equation. The other concept they had was called subsidiaryism. And the idea there was that no company should grow bigger than it needs to in order to do its business. You don't grow for growth's sake. You don't make money by growing. You make money by serving a marketplace.
So, who decides that?
What do you mean?
Who decides what the right level of growth is?
Well, I mean, I guess you do yourself, but you're not growing for growth's sake. You're growing because you have a market. Now, if your company grows to a certain size and then someone in the next town wants to, say you open a pizzeria and now you're serving lots of people and it's all great. I think what subsidiaryism would say is, all right, so it's a great pizza recipe. Let the guy in the next town open his own pizzeria rather than you expanding another branch and another branch and another branch. You know, so I mean, it's really distributism. It's something that Marshall McLuhan actually talked about, and, you know, Belloc and Chesterton, a bunch of philosophers looked at it after the popes talked about it. And now Pope Francis has actually revived the word when he's talking about sort of how we could do economic healing.
All right, Steve, thanks very much. Let's go now to San Francisco. And Danny, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good,
hey.
Thanks.
Listen, I have a question for your guest. One is, would you call what you're talking about stakeholder capitalism or democratic socialism? And in terms of the redistribution, not the redistribution, but the reallocation of actual wealth in the society, and how does that relate to what Bernie Sanders is talking about? It sounds very close.
It does, yeah.
Take my answer off the air.
All right.
The air.
Yeah, thanks very much.
I mean, if I were – I don't know how much Bernie Sanders can do other than hopefully change the tax code. So if we stopped punishing earnings and rewarding capital gains, it does change the landscape significantly, because then a whole lot of people will say, oh, I don't want to just get passive income. I want to create value, because that's what's being rewarded by the tax system instead of punished the way it is right now. I mean, everybody knows that the person who creates value is the sucker. You know, this is why GE in the 1990s got out of making stuff. They realized if they put $100,000 towards making washing machines, they will earn less money off that than they will lending $100,000 to people to buy washing machines, because then they sold off their productive industries and took and became more and more like a bank until 2007-08, when the banks crashed, and now they're, you know, getting back into actually making stuff again. So as a political model, maybe I sound jaded. I've got so little faith right now in those in political actors to enact significant positive economic change, and so much more faith in the potential for communities to develop local currencies and favor banks, to develop cooperatives. If you've got people with needs and people with skills, you've got the basis of an economy. All you need is a means of exchange at that point. And communities, we have the technologies to do that. That's the one great thing about Bitcoin and the blockchain, is we can authenticate transactions now with our little smartphones. So if we have that ability, we do not need the central capital system, really, in order to do stuff. So, I mean, if there were a suggestion for policymakers, it would be to get out of the way and to deregulate the potential of people to actually enact change.
Are there companies, are there tech companies that are actually creating something that you think promotes the kind of thing you're describing? I'm thinking of like Square, you know, which has helped really small businesses, food trucks, for example, get out from under Visa, you know.
Right. I mean, that's the great thing about, you know, Jack Dorsey and Evan Williams and these guys. And they, when they come up with their ideas, they are actually much more radical than what ends up happening. So PayPal originally was free. There wasn't going to be a charge on it. PayPal was going to make all of its money off the float. That is, by holding on to the money for 3 or 4 days until the package had been acknowledged that it was delivered on eBay. Then they released the money. They could have made all the profit they needed just on that. Then the banks came in and said, oh, wait a minute, you're not allowed to do that. Only official banks, you know, that have the queens and imprimatur are allowed to do that. So then they had to change their model. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the things he does and that they do are very much biased towards the fluidity of transaction. What often happens, though, in their case is they take too much venture capital, so they're forced to have more seemingly short-term profitable business models, or the traditional players in their space. I mean, big finance is a hard, hard industry to disrupt. It's the mother of all industries. And most disruptors end up disrupting their own industry, but really just all in the service of big finance rather than against it.
Here's a question from Kevin, who wrote us an email to say, finally, someone is speaking a very nuanced point about infinite growth on a finite world. I'd love to know if your guest has any insight into cooperative-owned structures and how they can help lead to a more sustainable and prosperous economy.
Yeah, I mean, I got a whole half a book of them. You know, this book, half the book is deconstructing the digital economy and what's wrong with it and how they've accepted corporatism as the unspoken rule set. You know, and that's everybody. I mean, that's where Hillary and people that I would love to be more progressive economic actors, they've got to understand. And poor Obama has to understand that the way to promote economic development is not to convince a bank to lend money to a corporation to open a factory to hire workers. It's to give communities the ability to transact amongst themselves and to produce. It's such an easier model, but one that people think is somehow strange or socialist or communist or idealistic. It's not crazy. If anybody who's – if you've spent any time on a community-supported agriculture farm, you're like, oh, this is farming. They make food and you can do it in a way that doesn't destroy the topsoil and you can – I mean, this is not rocket science.
But we have a system, a political system that where these – people who run things, that run the country, run the state, they rely on money from companies and corporations and rich people
that's why people have this intuitive attraction to both Trump and Sanders, because they say, well, both of these guys are – at least they're detached from that. They're not being lobbied into existence. There's something – you know, at – no one knows what Trump is really about. I mean, sure, but at least we know he's not being paid for. He's being paid for what? Of the gambling debts, I guess, of people who went to his Atlantic City casinos. I mean, there's a lot of blood in that money too, I'm sure. But they feel like he's not so entrenched in the system to not be able to see it slightly more objectively.
All right, back to the phones. Let's go again to San Jose. Prasad, welcome.
Hi. As per my understanding of Rushkoff, corporations should not take too much of venture investment because it focuses too much on value creation. So what is the take of the guest on companies such as Tom Shoes that operate on the model of sell one and donate one to the needy? For example, Tom Shoe, it got $300 million for a 50% stake from Bain Capital in 2014, thus making the founders multimillionaires.
What's the name of the company? Tom's Shoes.
Tom's Shoes.
Okay.
So my question is, should tech companies also explore similar models, make them transparent, and avoid their buses getting hit from rocks?
Douglas?
Well, I mean, there's a big expose on Tom's Shoes. I don't want to get into that. I mean, you've probably done a show on what was going on there. And I don't know enough factually about it. But models...
Is it a criticism of their model?
Yeah, a criticism of their model and the If you start giving shoes to people in developing nations, you put a local shoemaker out of business, you know. Yeah. So it's not it doesn't necessarily promote the kind of economic activity that would be a long-term solution. Still, it's nice to give a gift of shoes, and it makes someone feel better for buying another pair of shoes in their closet. I mean, obviously, the real solution is just don't buy another pair of shoes until your shoes really wear out, you know. Then think about where and how you're going to source that next pair of shoes. I don't see these sort of large scale consumption solutions as the best high leverage point. I look at sort of more the production solution. So when I look at a company, I say, oh well, what's the new phone? Is it called Fairphone? There's a phone that it's a modular phone, and they're looking at the entire supply chain of the phone, saying, how can we source a phone without sending little kids into caves in Africa to get our rare earth metals? And can it be modular so people can change a component in their phone without throwing away the phone altogether?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, the most environmentally sound cell phone you can have is the one you already have, you know, and not to get another one. And that's it's hard for people to understand that. Oh, I could go buy this green phone, this wood phone.
Yeah. Well, and also, you got to have the operating system that run the apps. And I mean, everything is planned obsolescence.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Here's another email from Michael, who writes, can you please ask your guest to speak to the importance of credit unions as a way of keeping money out of the banking system?
Oh, yeah. I mean, credit unions, which got such a bad rap over, 30, 40 years, they're finally coming back now and realizing, I did a talk to the credit union people maybe 10 years ago trying to tell them, this is your time. This is your time. And they were like, oh, no, we're so beleaguered. We've got to become more like banks. It's like, no, the banks people are seeing. They're seeing through it. The object of a credit union is the original role of banks. The idea is you get deposits from people, and then you lend out those deposits to other people who like need money to buy a house or start a business. And you charge a little bit of a difference between those two so that, that you make your profit, which then goes back into the company. Now, with a bank, the object of the game is to make that spread as large as possible so you can deliver as much to your shareholders as possible. Or you take the deposits, but you don't reinvest it in the community. You just stick it in high leveraged, you know, derivatives of derivatives of derivatives and credit default swaps and all that other insanity. So the role of the corporate bank in a community is to extract money from the community. That's its job. The role of a credit union, which is a nonprofit, is to circulate monies, to distribute the cash in the community in the way that promotes economic development. And finally, people are understanding that, oh, you know, no, the website and the app might not be quite as married to Quicken as Chase or Citibank.
So,
where
do you do your banking?
Ugh, I'm a mess right now. I mean, luckily, I became I teach at a public university now, Queens College at CUNY, and there is a credit union with that. So I'm actually finally moving everything into there. I mean, even in my own town, there's a local bank, you know, Astoria Savings. It's a local bank, and then there's the Chase. And you see, the local bank, they support the Little League team, and they're there at the fair, and they're investing in our community and the Chase.
It's and like then you travel and you can't find an ATM.
Yeah, but you can actually. They're part of networks and all. And we got to look at what are we optimizing for? Convenience or sustainability? And they're not always exactly the same. And the kind of convenience that you lose usually is the kind of convenience that's just the convenience that makes it so you don't have to look other people in the eye and enjoy your life.
All right. Douglas Rushkoff, his new book is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And tonight you're going to be at the Commonwealth Club.
I am, and hopefully see you all.
All right. I got the sense you're just getting warmed up, so I'm sure there's more for you to talk about. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Suki Lewis, and Tina Lauerberg, our engineer today, Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.